I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. Later in the hour, we'll be hearing from the author of a brand new book about social media and the importance of using it wisely and with restraint. But we're going to begin with one of the country's most prominent commentators and columnists, George F. Will, whose most recent book, his 16th, is titled American Happiness and Discontents, The Unruly Torrent, 2008 to 2020. A generous helping of the columns he has written for the Washington Post over the last dozen years. Mr. Will, I especially enjoyed the introduction to your book in which you give us background in your approach to writing columns, which you've done for the Washington Post since 1974. One thing you say that leapt out at me was the fact that most Americans do not read newspapers, let alone the commentary columns, is actually emancipating for columnists. Explain what you mean, why that is so.
What it means is that the people who come to the page come of their own volition. They want to read opinions, which means they've probably got a lively interest in all the subjects of the day and a well-stocked mind with information. Therefore, A, you don't need to, you don't dare to write down to your readers. You can treat them as, an intellectually upscale audience. And the vocabulary can be different. You can assume a stock of knowledge. You don't have to invent the wheel every time, saying, by the way, there are three branches of government. So in that sense, it makes dealing with issues in 750 words easier.
You also, I think, so aptly describe the current media environment as a blitzkrieg of words written and spoken. In any respect, do you think your work as a columnist has changed because you are writing in the midst of such a different media environment than was in place, for instance, back in 1974?
I sort of hope it hasn't changed because I ignore social media. I don't tweet. I wouldn't know how to tweet, to tell you the truth. Someone on my staff twice a week tweets out words from my columns twice a week. That's it. I'm told I have a Facebook page. I've never seen it. So I just ignore that stuff. I still think the printed word is the primary carrier of ideas, books, newspapers, magazines. And we all are aware, and you're in this business, you're aware that people now tend to live in intellectual silos. They choose the congenial sources of news, which tends to drive us apart and to increase polarization, frankly. So I try to ignore that. I like to say that the columns I write, like the ones in the book, are accessible to people who are not in intellectual silos.
Speaking of intellectual silos, I do want to ask you about something that you say about higher education and in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that my full-time job is teaching at a local liberal arts college here. You say at one point, again, this is in the introduction and it's a point made in several different columns gathered in your book, America's most dispiriting intellectual phenomenon is the degradation of higher education, which is being swept by two plagues to which it should be immune, fads and hysterias. I'd love to hear more about what the heart of your concern is in that respect.
Well, as you know, two sections in the book. One deals with parenting, and it goes right on to the next about academia. And they're related. The way we are parenting now, and isn't it interesting that the noun parent has become a verb, the way we're parenting produces bubble-wrap children, insulated from failure, told from birth that they're awesome, that we all live in Lake Wobegon, where all the children are above average. And they raise risk-averse children who get to campus, and lo and behold, the first thing they're looking for is freedom from speech, not of speech. They're looking for safe spaces where they'll be safe from microaggressions. And they want bias response teams touring the country looking for misbehavior. As our campuses have become ideologically monochrome, entirely dominated by progressive left-wing views, always in the name of diversity, interesting enough. Our campuses have become places where everyone looks different, but everyone thinks alike. Diversity in everything but thought. And it's deeply depressing because our great research universities have evolved over 800 years through thickets of political and ecclesiastical interference. And we can kick all this away in one or two generations of people who are not in higher education for education, but rather to inflict indoctrination.
We're speaking with George F. Will about his most recent book called American Happiness and Discontents, The Unruly Torrent, 2008 to 2020. This is a collection of a plethora of his columns from recent years, ranging over a wide expanse of different topics. One of the things that you point out in the introduction, which I think is so interesting, is that we will see actually very little here about our most recent presidents. You write, they permeate the national consciousness to a degree that is unhealthy and, strictly speaking, un-Republican and anti-constitutional. Entire forests are felled to produce books about presidents, but they are temporary. They come and go. Has that always been your opinion, or is that a realization you have come to more recently, that we tend to think about our presidents and their significance far too much?
I've had this opinion for a long time. It was deepened, of course, by the experience of our 45th president. You know, when Senator Bennett of Colorado made a kind of lackluster, half-hearted attempt to get the Democratic nomination in 2020, he said, vote for me and you'll get a president you won't have to think about for weeks at a time. I said, that's my man. That's the guy I want. Presidents are just too much with us. And frankly, politics is too much with us. I'm a firm believer in the axiom, it's a truism really, that politics is downstream from culture. And it's cultural questions, such as you and I just touched on about parenting and what's happening on our campuses. And of course, what happens on campus doesn't stay on campus. These, it seems to me, are the neglected issues of our time as we focus entirely too much on what's happening in Washington and entirely too much in Washington on what's happening with the presidency.
Now, are you saying that the presidents and what they do, what they think, what they try to accomplish doesn't matter, and that's why we shouldn't pay attention to them? I don't mean don't matter at all, but don't matter as much as they think we matter? Or is it that we harm ourselves or our collective good when we focus on presidents too much at the neglect of more important things?
Both. By focusing on the presidents and necessarily therefore on politics, we're neglecting the fact that politics isn't the be-all and end-all of American life. But beyond that, we're neglecting Congress. We're neglecting the courts. We're neglecting the judicial supervision of the excesses of our democracy. I'm one of those conservatives who believes that we don't want judicial restraint. We want an engaged judiciary protecting our rights from majority abuses. Some people have said judicial review and all that is a counter-majoritarian dilemma. I don't think it's a dilemma at all. I think when courts become deferential, too deferential to legislatures, be they Congress or city councils, that deference becomes a dereliction of the judicial duty to enforce the laws properly and the Constitution rigorously.
Mm. You write at one point, this touches on the overarching theme of the book, happiness has been elusive for this dyspeptic nation in which too many people think and act as tribes and define their happiness as some other tribe's unhappiness. That seems like a trap from which it is not easy to escape.
It's not easy to escape, and Wisconsin, it seems to me, is a case study in this. The bitterness of politics is astonishing today. And what makes the bitterness so hard to cope with is it's not clear what kind of legislative agenda could ameliorate this, could mollify the people who are angry. Because as I say, and as you just quoted, they're angry not about the absence of this or that program or law. They're angry at the other side for existing, which makes it really hard to come to terms in a kind of democratic culture of sensible persuasion. Hmm.
A last question. I think many people, whether they admire you or tend to criticize you, may be surprised to know that you are actually from the Midwest, that is, born in Champaign, Illinois. How much of the Midwest remains with you in terms of emotionally and intellectually as you look at the world and understand it?
A lot. I always think of myself as a Champaign, Urbana kid from central Illinois, where, by the way, late at nights I could get the Milwaukee Braves games back in the day. I'm from Milwaukee, and I ought to know it's draft brewed Blatt's beer wherever you go and all that. I actually was a camp counselor during the summer at Camp Cumberland or Camp Brigadoon in Cumberland, Wisconsin, not far from Rice Lake. So I spent a bunch of time there and a lot of time in Milwaukee because I was on the board of the Bradley Foundation, and Bud Selig is one of my very best friends. So I'm a Midwesterner through and through.
And I appreciated this chance to speak with you, George F. Will. Thank you so much. Best wishes.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
The full title of George F. Will's most recent book is American Happiness and Discontents, The Unruly Torrent, 2008 to 2020, published by Hachette. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part two. I have read a number of different books concerning social media, the way in which it pervades so much of modern life, and the harms that can come from being, in a sense, addicted to social media or misusing it. And, of course, a lot has also been written about the way in which social media and its misuse have also done great harm to us collectively as a nation, to say nothing of each of us individually if we happen to fall into that trap. Of all of the books that I have read about social media, the one that I think I have enjoyed the most and from which I have learned the most is a brand new book called You Are What You Click: How Being Selective, Positive, and Creative Can Transform Your Social Media Experience. The author of the book, Brian Primack, is a experienced expert on media and technology and has spoken extensively on the topic. He is the dean of the College of Education and Health Professions at the University of Arkansas, where he is also professor of public health and medicine. And I really am appreciative of the opportunity to speak with him about this really intriguing book, which is published by Chronicle Prism. Dr. Brian Primack, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg, for that very kind introduction. It is truly great to be here.
I would love to know first, briefly, something of your background in terms of how you have come to focus so much of your professional energies on this particular topic and concern. And did that arise as, in a sense, social media arose in all of our lives?
It did. And I have been interested in child development ever since I was in high school and college and started volunteering in that area. When I finished college, I went into teaching. I eventually studied child development, and I became a dean of students. And then I eventually segued to medicine, where I was able to take those ideas a little bit further and treat the whole person. I went into family practice. And then it's probably not surprising that when I chose a research career, I really wanted to mix the two. I wanted to better understand children, and really all human development. And what I just kept coming back to was how influential the media were in child development, in giving us all scripts in our lives that sometimes could be beneficial to us, but often were not, as you mentioned in your introduction. And so as social media rose, I realized how extreme the exposure was to social media, and that this was an area where people really needed more practical, evidence-based information. They needed to figure out a way to balance the challenges of technology and the benefits. And so that's why I created You Are What You Click.
I want you to tell our listeners a painful story from the introduction to the book, which involves a truly horrific hate crime. And it's in the introduction, and I think it's worth touching on now, because it speaks to the urgency with which you have approached this topic. I mean, a gradually increasing sense of urgency over the years, but that was very much heightened by this very unfortunate tragedy that was very close to home for you in more ways than one. If you don't mind sharing this story.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had been studying these ideas for a couple of decades. And as an academic, you know, you publishing dozens of papers and mentoring students and talking about media and health continuously. And so, of course, I had thought about writing a book, but it was only until, you know, my experience as part of the Pittsburgh Tree of Life shooting that I realized just what a double-edged sword social media are in today's world. On the one side, the perpetrator of the crime had been very, very active on social media and had been gathering a lot of encouragement for his very anti-Semitic views and for his very extreme actions on a particular social media platform. And indeed, the moment before he started shooting, the last thing that he did was notified his social media followers what he was doing. So I realized how it's not just that social media can breed feelings of depression and anxiety and isolation like we see in our studies, but also hatred. On the other hand, social media can definitely catalyze connection, warmth, generosity, and we saw that as well. I mean, in the aftermath of the tragedy, social media facilitated all kinds of outpouring of support. Within just a few hours, the Muslim community had raised enough money for all 11 funerals. And that just wouldn't have been possible without the digital media and technology and social media that we have today. So it really brought this double-edged sword very personally into my life that I had been studying very professionally, and I really decided I needed to sit down and put the book together.
You have put together a book that, in a sense, is building the concept of what you like to call a healthy technology diet. And it may not be immediately apparent to our listeners. In fact, it wasn't immediately apparent to me until I started reading your book a little bit, that the title of the book is very consciously crafted to parallel the common phrase, you are what you eat. So you are what you click. And the idea that we should think of this in a sense in nutritional terms. Explain a little further why you think that is such an apt description of what you think we need to think about when it comes to social media, this idea of the diet.
Yeah, absolutely, Greg. So obviously it's not a perfect analogy. I mean, social media, we probably don't need to survive as much as we need food, but there are a lot of similarities. They're both things that we use hours a day. Most recent data for social media is about 3 to 4 hours a day, multiple times a day. People have various diets. They consume media, and they consume, you know, certain types of media. Some people will prefer to do this type rather than this type, almost like a vegetarian versus a Mediterranean diet or something like that. It's also easy to overindulge. It's easy to maybe start by having something that's nutritious, but then to fall into difficult patterns. And if you think about it, just eating whatever you feel like at the moment, it probably is not very ideal. And so several decades ago, public health experts realized this and came up with the food pyramid to give practical suggestions on how to balance all the needs of food for our bodies. But at this point, as a society, also as you mentioned in your introduction, we're not quite there yet. We're just sort of using whatever we feel like at the moment. We're not being very intentional, and we're not being very goal-oriented using social media. And it does fill our minds and bodies with scripts and attitudes that really can affect our health. And because I've been learning that over the years, I really wanted to do something that was very practical, that was very evidence-based at this point, and just to say we really want to maximize the value of social and digital media that can be very, very remarkable tools, but to also mitigate some of the challenges.
Hmm. Somewhere in the book you point out that the term social media was only coined in 2004. And a lot of us have not even been part of social media as long as that. I mean, I first came on to Facebook, I don't remember exactly, maybe 4 or 5 years after that. But for just about all of us, this really is a new phenomenon. And we probably can't point to too many things that have so radically altered our lives so quickly. And without us having a chance to kind of take it in gradually and sort of sort out what place it should have in our lives. I mean, this really feels in some respects unprecedented.
Yeah, I would agree with that. As you said, that even the term social media seems to have started in major usage in 2004. So what we see is that in less than two decades, all of a sudden something that was being used almost not at all is being used by 4 billion people on the planet. It's being used for hours a day. And so it kind of makes sense that we're not going to be very expert at it as a society yet. We're not really thinking very carefully about the best way to use this very nuanced tool. We're just kind of diving in. And the exciting thing, I think, about the book is that I really have learned over the years that a lot of the challenges we have with social media really are avoidable if we do use it with a little bit more intention. If we're thinking about how to tailor it to our personality, something that a lot of people probably don't think about, something, you know, if we think about it more in terms of really analyzing and evaluating what we see and why we see those things and what our response is going to be, you know, to them. To think about all of the nuanced ways that we can use this tool. And so I think that ultimately it should be very empowering and not just something that we need to trudge through.
Right. And, of course, we should underscore the fact that you are not calling for abstinence from social media, and you acknowledge that, at least for many of us, that would be all but impossible. That is, it would be all but impossible for us to carry on with our professional lives without social media having at least some presence. And so this book is not about abstinence. This book is about healthy consumption of social media or healthy participation of social media.
Yes, exactly. As you say, it probably wouldn't be very feasible to suggest to people not to use social media in today's world. But I also don't think it really would be desirable. I mean, this is a remarkable tool that can be used in wonderful ways to increase meaning in our lives, to promote relationships. However, just because it can also do the opposite, it can also breed difficult feelings and can actually impair relationships. We just need to be more cautious about how we think about it. Now, some people very well might look through all of the information and make the decision, I want to go and have a life without social media. And that is absolutely fine for those individuals. But the book is really more geared toward people who see it more like food. It's something that is part of my life, and I am going to use it every day in certain ways. How can I do it in a way that's nuanced and that's benefiting me rather than benefiting the platform?
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Brian Primack about his new book called You Are What You Click, How Being Selective, Positive, and Creative Can Transform Your Social Media Experience. Early in the book, you cite a statistic that I found amazing. That is that the fastest growing population of users of social media are adults 65 and older. You tell us in the past decade, their use has increased by more than a factor of five. I'm not exactly sure if you mean that more and more older adults are using social media or older adults are using social media more and more, I mean, in increasing amounts. So I would love to have you clarify that and also have you talk about why that is. Is it just that older adults are kind of late to the party and are just catching on and just getting swept up in it? Or do you think there are other things going on there that would explain this particular statistic?
Yeah, absolutely. So both of the interpretations that you had turn out to be correct. Older people are using social media, a higher percentage of them are using more social media, and they are also using dramatically more social media every year. And I do think that a lot of it is, as you say, about availability and about, you know, recognizing that this is a way to, say, connect with family, and then all of a sudden it becomes leveraged as a way to also connect with friends and ideas and people from the past and that kind of thing. And what we see with older people is that I think there's particular opportunity there, because I think that older people in particular, at least as of right now, maybe not being as familiar with a lot of the technology as younger people because it's so relatively new, are in that situation where they are not necessarily using it optimally. They don't necessarily understand exactly what all of the possibilities are before them and what all of the potential pitfalls are. So I think that this is a population that we really do need to think about. And so I have some specific information in the book about it, because everyone needs to learn to use social media better. But in this particular population, it is maybe even more of a double-edged sword, because if people start to use in ways that are challenging and start to feel even more isolated, then that's obviously going to be a particularly bad person, or I mean a bad problem for somebody who is, you know, reflecting on an entire life. On the other hand, if it's going to be a source of empowerment and creativity and, you know, for reconnection in a society where older people are often living alone, you know, compared with, for example, Asian societies, most people in our society, older people are living in a more isolated way. And so those need for connection is that much more important.
Mm. And of course, social media provides a certain kind of connection, but it's not necessarily a full or complete connection with others. At one point, you describe that these relationships that we have with certain people in these virtual formats might feel like the real thing, but are not necessarily the real thing. And we need to be conscious of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So one metaphor, for example, is to think of an emoji. You know, an emoji is one of those smiley faces that you see or some other image and, you know, next to the words in, say, a social media post. And those can be very, very useful and very, very expressive. But they're never really going to replace, they're never going to be the gold standard for communication and warmth. You know, we've evolved over millennia to need socially a real human face. You know, the real human face has 43 muscles in it. And so all of the different combinations of them being on and off can give so many trillions of different combinations that it's not going to approach what you see in that blob. But is that blob still useful? If that's the only way we can connect with somebody, it very well may be. So it sort of is a representation of this bigger idea that you're talking about, which is that, yes, we should be using this as a tool, but we need to remember that it is not going to replace in-person communication. It is not going to fix our communication and connection problems.
Right. I sometimes find myself realizing that when I am on Facebook, that there is a big difference between those with whom I'm interacting, where they are people who are in my life. I work with them, or I live next door to them, or we go to the same church, versus people who I only know on Facebook, who are entirely virtual acquaintances. And I think your book hints at this, that it can really make a difference in terms of how many hundreds of virtual friends you have, where that is the only plane on which that friendship exists and functions, is on a virtual platform versus in real life.
Yes. Greg, this is, I think, a critical thing. It's one of those nuances that I was talking about before that I think really will help people use social media better. We've actually found in evidence-based studies involving thousands of people that the more people that you have in your social media circles that you know well from in-person relationships, those become more positive over time. However, the more people that you are socially connected through social media to who you do not know on a face-to-face basis, though, more of that is actually connected with more depression, more anxiety, and even more feelings of isolation. And you think to yourself, well, why does it matter? I mean, isn't it just, you know, somebody that maybe is a friend of a friend or somebody who has something in common with me and, you know, puts me in their list. But the fact is that that's just not how it happens in the world. When you don't have that prior connection with somebody, you're more likely to fall into some kind of a problematic communication. You're more likely to have some kind of a misstep or a gaffe. And so this is one thing that people should at least be thinking about. I mean, they still may decide, I want to have a certain number of people that I'm connected with that I have never met before. You know, there's no sort of definite yes or no, but they should at least be aware of the fact that in evidence-based studies, the more people you're connected to who you don't have a prior relationship with, that actually does translate into sometimes negative emotional feelings.
You cite a study in which you had a hand, I believe, that demonstrated a definite connection between usage of social media, that is, escalating use of social media, and escalating numbers in terms of loneliness, depression, anxiety. And one of the things I most appreciated about the way you discussed this is that you anticipated a question that I immediately had, which is, what's the chicken and what's the egg? I mean, is it that when you use social media too much or in undisciplined fashion, you become depressed, anxious, or whatever? Or is it that you're depressed and anxious, so you turn to social media to try to ameliorate some of those negative feelings and emotions that you are experiencing in your life? Your study actually was of a nature that in which we could really kind of determine which was coming first, at least in general terms. Can you explain how your study was so definitive when it comes to that matter of what was driving what?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and of course, no single study is going to be entirely definitive, but this study definitely did try to get at chicken and egg and did have a very specific result. So I absolutely forgive everybody for not ever seeing this, because it was published sort of very quietly in December of 2020, while a lot of other things were going on. You'll recall that there was a contested election. There was COVID was raging, the first vaccines were being given, and so there wasn't a whole lot of news about this study when it was published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. But I do think it was an important one, because it was the first major and large study to look longitudinally over time at people and look at their social media and depression. And what we found was that people who used a lot of social media at sort of the beginning of the study, within 6 months, they were much more likely to become depressed if they then compared with if they used very little social media. But at the same time, we also looked for the other direction. We also said, well, is there a relationship between being depressed at the beginning of the study and are depressed people over 6 months, you know, more likely to start using more social media? And they were not. So because we found that the relationship goes in one direction, but it didn't go in the other direction, that is at least food for thought, and it at least calls for more research to determine if this is a real effect.
Hmm. We're speaking with Brian Primack about his book, You Are What You Click: How Being Selective, Positive, and Creative Can Transform Your Social Media Experience. The subtitle really kind of speaks to the heart of the sort of technological diet which you think people should be putting together for themselves. And among the sort of premises, basic premises with which you shape this concept, there are two things that I think are particularly worth highlighting. First, you think any such plan needs to be simple in terms of its basic construct. But the other thing, it needs to be highly individualized. In other words, you are prepared to fully acknowledge that we are not all wired the same, and that rampant social media is going to affect each of us in a particular way. And so it is a real mistake to sort of issue kind of blanket recommendations in terms of how all of us should consume or participate in social media. Can you tell us more about that, the importance of this being approached in individualized fashion, and also the way in which any such plan needs to be simple?
Yeah, absolutely. So it would be wonderful if I could just say, well, you know what, Greg, I figured it out. Just use 46 minutes a day. Just do this and this, and you're going to be great. But like you're saying, we are all very, very different people, and that's just not going to work in terms of a one-size-fits-all. And the importance of personality is so critical that I actually have in the book a personality quiz that people can take. And then the subsequent five chapters are about five different personality types, things like whether you're extroverted or introverted, and what having that particular personality characteristic implies for optimal social media use for you. And so I think that it's really important for us to realize that it's not just going to be something that we can all do. It's got to be something that we're all going to think about on a, you know, on a deeper level. Now, that being said, I do think that there are some basic principles. It's not just a kind of big mess. I really, you know, as I've been thinking about this over the last couple of decades, I really have gotten everything into these one of these three sections of the pyramid. Be selective, be positive, and then the peak of the pyramid is be creative. Now, obviously, those things are going to be different for different individuals, and that's why the different sections of the book flesh out what it really means to be selective in different ways, what it means to be positive, depending on people's different context of how they're using, and to be creative and really bring it to the next level. And so it is simple in that it's three levels, and it's not 127 things that everybody has to remember, but it still is going to be very personalized.
Mm. I really appreciated the way in which you lay out so many of these concepts, and in a way that really makes sense, and the specifics are helpful without being prescriptive. That is, you know, you tell us so much about what we need to know about each of these concepts, but then, you know, it is left up to us in order to do with them what we determine to be best. One of the things that you talk about in terms of how much we use social media is that there seems to be a very different harm in terms of sheer amount of time spent versus the frequency with which we return to social media. And, you know, at a careless glance, that might seem like the same thing, but of course it really isn't. It's one thing to kind of sit on social media for a long, long time. It's another thing to repeatedly return to it over and over again, which is what is frequency. And you could total up those minutes and it might not be, or might be equal, or might be more than the time someone else spends kind of in it for a longer stretch of time. Explain why there is such a difference in terms of the impact of duration versus frequency.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you think about amount, you can think about a lot of different things. You can think about, like you're saying, the total time, say, someone is doing something, but you can also think about the frequency. So, you know, maybe you and I are both using social media for 2 hours a day, but you are using it an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening, whereas I'm kind of chopping it up into little 3-minute bursts here and there every, you know, time I'm, you know, getting up to go to the water cooler or something like that. We, in that case, even though the total amount of time is very similar, the frequency is very different, and that probably has major differences in terms of effects on us. At least that's what we found in our research. So with regard to time, for example, platforms are meant to be sticky. This is the terminology that is used by marketers. And so it is important to sort of say, what is the right amount of time for me that I feel good about spending on this so that I just avoid being stuck and I take a little bit of control of that? But it's also about the frequency, because a lot of the problem or challenge seems to be, in data from the neuroscience world, the shifting of focus. We really need time. Our brains need sort of time and attention, and this is what's related to a lot of the mindfulness stuff we hear about these days, into really being able to focus on one thing or another. Well, social media, if you're using it every, you know, 15 minutes in little 2-minute bursts, that shifting of focus, you can see, is going to be dramatically different. And that very well may interfere with normal brain processes related to things like memory, sleep, cognition, and more. And so that's why there's more than just the total number and the amount of time that we need to think of. To give you one other quick example, I often ask people, how many different platforms do you use? And they sort of look at me like, why would it matter how many platforms I use? If I'm using 2 hours, I'm using 2 hours, right? Well, we actually found that if you take two people and one of them is dividing their 2 hours into 7 platforms, and the other one is dividing their 2 hours and focusing on just 2 platforms, the one who is using 7 different platforms, even though it's the exact same amount of time, is 3 times as likely to be depressed as the other person, 3 times as likely to feel socially isolated as the other person. So this is another one of those nuances that we hope that people will be thinking about, is it's not just how I select the right amount of time, it's not just how I select the frequency and I think about that actively, but it's also which little worlds am I inhabiting? We don't know exactly why we have this effect with the 7 different platforms versus 2, but one of those possibilities is that each of these worlds is very idiosyncratic. It is, you know, very individual, and if you are kind of spending a little bit of time here and there, you don't necessarily know the conventions, you don't necessarily know the culture. I mean, it's almost like trying to be really good friends with 7 different groups of people in school or something like that. It's hard to maintain without causing some kind of a miscommunication, a challenge, or a gaffe.
Mm. You do call at one point, and I think rightly so, social media as a lightning rod for negativity. And one of your points of advice is that it can make a huge difference if we are able to buffer the negatives and accentuate the positives. Briefly, how does one go about doing that? What are at least a couple of guiding principles there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right that it's a lightning rod for negativity. You know, it's a little bit like road rage. For example, when you're driving in a car, it's very easy to sort of dehumanize the person who is driving that car in front of you. It's very, very easy to start yelling and screaming at the person because you don't think of them as a person. You don't think of them as, that could be my grandma. You know, you think of that person as you know, dehumanized and just as that mean red car, which is very different than what that person probably, you know, is actually like. And you really don't know the full story of why they're getting in front of you on the highway or whatever. So this is why it's easy to fall into road rage in the setting of a car. And we see the same thing with regard to social media, because people are sort of hidden, quote unquote, behind avatars. And so you don't really think of that person as a human being. You think of that person as a collection of, you know, bits and bytes. And that's one reason why, and we discussed this briefly earlier, it is a valuable thing to actually know people in real life and then extend your relationships with them using social media, but not necessarily form entire relationships based on social media, because you don't have that overall context. Another example that we give is that it's very, very easy to have more negativity in social media when you are just responding to everybody. In other words, if you go on, the way we are sort of trained to use social media is you go onto your platform of choice and you announce to the entire world something. Well, the fact is that a lot of people very well might find that negative, even if you're not expecting that. You know, all you're doing is innocently posting, you know, a picture of your beautiful lunch and that burger and just how, you know, wonderful it looks, but your vegetarian friends are not going to be happy with that. And so one of the other things that we talk about in the book is how to leverage the tools of social media for more individual and small group communications, because there you're more likely to share those things with the people who are really going to appreciate it, the people who are going to care, and the people who are not going to necessarily receive it in some kind of an unintentional negative way.
Mm. You say at one point in the book, we can use social media to choose the company we want to keep. And indeed, in certain exchanges, it's probably for a certain company of acquaintances or friends that we would share certain things, and in other things, perhaps share more widely or more selectively or narrowly. Well, that and much more wonderful advice is to be found in this terrific book published by Chronicle Prism. Again, You Are What You Click, How Being Selective, Positive, and Creative Can Transform Your Social Media Experience. Dr. Brian Primack, thank you so much for creating this marvelous book.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed being here on the program and discussing all these ideas. So thank you so much for your interest.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Dr. Thomas Carr, director of the paleontology program at Carthage College, will be here with a couple of different students and a colleague to talk about their most recent dinosaur dig. On Wednesday, Adam Levine and his much-discussed book called The Great Upheaval.